You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Frankie Barnhill, filling in for Gemma Gaudette. Well, we've made it to Friday, and it's time for the Friday Reporter Roundtable. Our panel today is Heath Druzin with Boise State Public Radio News, Harrison Berry of the Boise Weekly, and Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side. Welcome, everybody.
Hi, Frankie.
Thanks for having us.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. And Heath, I want to start with you and with really some really somber news on the coronavirus front in Idaho. We've had another week of soaring case numbers and sadly a deadly week. What are you seeing?
Yeah, you know, I'm looking right now at the graph. The state puts out a lot of different numbers, and I'm looking at the graph that charts the deaths from complications from COVID-19. And it's definitely not the trend that we want to see here in the state. You know, you see a large downward trend coming from April into May into early June, and then it just starts spiking in July. We've had our deadliest single days, and depending on how you do the math, it looks like roughly the last 2 weeks really have been the worst stretch in that time. We've had the numbers kind of lag, so it's a little hard to know exactly what it is because the local health districts will report something, and it takes the state a while to catch up. But we've had something like 60 deaths in the last 10 days, and that's out of a total of 177 across the state in about 4.5 months. So certainly a very alarming trend.
Yeah, and by my count of the official numbers, in July alone, we've had 85 deaths out of that total 177 you mentioned. So almost 50% of those deaths came just this month. And we'll see what the numbers are today to close out July. And just a note, we also covered on Wednesday's show with our medical experts that Idaho is one of the worst states when it comes to hospital bed capacity. The Idaho Statesman is reporting that Idaho's testing positivity percentage is still one of the highest in the country. I mean, yeah, as you said, it's just not going in the right direction. Is there any indication that these numbers are going to improve soon?
I mean, that's very hard for me to say, but I will say the state hasn't really been changing their approach. The numbers, I mean, we're pretty much locked into 500 or more new cases every day, which is way higher than it was at the beginning or even in the middle of the pandemic. And, you know, Governor Brad Little has been very quiet about this. He's really left it to local health districts. And I'm not really sure it's clear that every local health district is equipped to deal with a global pandemic. So you've got this sort of patchwork approach, which is kind of a microcosm of what we've seen on a national scale, where, you know, you've got Boise and a few other cities like Ketchum, I believe, and Moscow up north, where they have mask ordinances. But the vast majority of the state doesn't have that. And the vast majority of the state pretty much has all businesses being allowed to be open. So it's very inconsistent. Obviously, you know, there's free movement of people in the state and in the country. So the disease doesn't necessarily respect county borders and city borders. So there's not much of a concerted effort state. And, you know, that probably is complicating things.
Right. And of course, to mention that Ada and Canyon counties are two of the hot spots. And additionally, you know, this week we saw our youngest death, someone in their 30s in Idaho. So I guess I wonder, Heath, more, you know, about the backlash. You mentioned mask wearing. What is the backlash that we're seeing continuing in Idaho when it comes to wearing masks, whether or not a county or health district or city has mandated that?
Yeah. So to be clear, you know, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the kind of national body on healthcare here, they say that masks are very effective in preventing the spread of the disease. But unfortunately, it's become very politicized, and some people see wearing a mask as an infringement on their rights, as opposed to what almost every medical expert says it is, which is just a way to keep people safe and to slow the spread of this disease. So yeah, you've seen people get very heated about it, and you've seen politicians actually take up the cause all the way up to the national level. And, you know, some of the folks who have been very adamant about not wearing a mask have actually gotten COVID-19. So, yeah, it's unfortunately, you know, health recommendations have sort of entered the political sphere, as seems everything else has in 2020. So you've got medical experts who are saying, you know, this is really for public health being sort of tarred by political accusations.
Yeah, and to note, one of those higher profile folks, not an elected official, but former presidential candidate Herman Cain passed away, and he was fairly outspoken about being critical or questioning masks. Is there a rally in Twin Falls that's happening this weekend that's around this issue?
Yeah, there is a rally tomorrow. The keynote speaker is going to be Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan. And by my count, there's at least seven legislators. Idaho legislator. It's called Freedom is the Cure, which is clearly sort of a dig at efforts to slow the spread of COVID-19 through policy. And the folks who are speaking there is sort of a who's who of COVID-19 skeptics and folks like Janice McGeehan, who have been critical of any state restrictions aimed at stopping the spread of COVID-19. So this is really a rally to argue against restrictions, even though the state really has very few restrictions remaining right now, despite our numbers.
Right. And counterpoint to that, Dr. David Pate, who we have on our doctor medical panel every Wednesday here at Idaho Matters, just this past week, he actually talked about hoping to see the legislature change potentially how health districts manage these kinds of questions, because he's been very disappointed with certain districts not taking mandates or making them, rather. So definitely a lot of conversation around masks still continuing. And I should note, you know, as at the same time, hey, it's almost August and we're trying to figure out how to open schools. The Boise School District will make a decision this coming week. NAMPA announced that they're going to go online for the first 2 weeks of school and shifted back their start date. Meanwhile, universities like Boise State, they're still planning on starting classes in person with students in dorms. So a lot to watch on the education front. Harrison, I'd like to turn to you because we've been talking about COVID-19 in light of the physical effects it has on people, the physical health for folks. But of course, there's also significant mental health concerns that come with this pandemic. And I want to note, if you are struggling, there's help. Here's the number to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1-800-950-6264. Again, that number, 1-800-950-6264. Please seek help. Harrison, what are you hearing from local mental health advocates right now when it comes to the coronavirus?
Well, I don't think it would surprise anyone that there has been a dramatic impact on mental health due to COVID-19 and just the stresses of the pandemic itself. But one of the things that we've been hearing from people, particularly on the mental health side of things, is that there has been a delayed reaction, that in the earlier parts of the pandemic, or during the early phases of the pandemic, those services were seeing modest increases in, or even static numbers in terms of calls to the Idaho, you know, suicide prevention hotline or at the Women's and Children's Alliance. Now we're starting to see those numbers of calls, those calls for service dramatically increasing. And the science backs that up. At other times of national crisis, there has been, you know, a few months lag in demand for those kinds of services, but now we're seeing a pretty sharp increase. It's not that those problems haven't always been there, but it is that the pandemic does appear to be exacerbating those problems and making them considerably worse.
Yeah, that's a really good point on this very somber topic. We know that Idaho, for instance, has a consistently high rate of suicide even before the pandemic. So it's very clear to these officials and advocates that there really is, this is exacerbating the problem. Are they getting, do they need more resources? What are they hoping for?
Well, some of those organizations, I'm sure, would say, yeah, we could use some financial assistance. I imagine at the WCA, they could use other forms of assistance as well. I mean, particularly in regards to the WCA, we've been looking at they report a 93% increase in calls related to domestic violence in the first quarter of 2020, compared to the same period last year. And oftentimes, a lot of those kinds of the assistance that they provide is in the form simply of cash, of getting people in rough domestic situations, giving them the capital that it takes to leave those some of those negative environments. I mean, imagine suddenly being told you have to stay at home. Being at home is the safest place as you can be during a pandemic. But if you're in one of these types of abusive situations, obviously, home is as dangerous or worse than being out. Money, material aid, and other forms, I think, is definitely on the wish list of a number of these organizations.
Yeah, and that's a good point you make. For many of us, the privilege of being at home and having that be a safe place is not the reality for many people. Mike, KIVI is also following the mental health crisis associated with COVID-19, and you published a piece this week on how folks can cope with the increased anxiety that comes with a pandemic. What can you share for our audience about that?
Yeah, I don't think it's any big news to the people who are sitting at home that there's been a rush of anxiety associated with the pandemic, and as well as being trapped at home as a person who suffers from anxiety. I can tell you it's like the worst possible thing is to be put in a box and just kind of have to sit there and stew over, doom scroll through Twitter and see all the news that's out there. So we talked to one expert, Dr. Jim Polo, and he talked to us a little bit about kind of the evolutionary reasons behind why anxiety would pop up. And it's not just about the possible pending doom or the fact that there's a virus out there. It's about the fact that we're social creatures and we're limiting ourselves to the interactions among family, which is great. And it's great if you do have that family nearby, but especially if you don't, you are alienating yourself in the exact time where you need that outreach with other individuals. So that's why, you hear what sounds like, semantics, doctors trying to change us from saying social distancing to instead refer to it as physical distancing, because you shouldn't be distancing yourself from these networks that give you support. There was one expert who referred to it as living off the interest that has been built over years in your relationships. And eventually that interest wears out. And then what happens with those relationships? You start losing the principle, and that's not what you want to do. So connection is being super critically important, making phone calls, using the mobile platforms as difficult as it is, because a lot of these social media platforms feed into the anxiety that you're receiving in the first place. But looking up the ways you can use these platforms in responsible and healthy ways to reinforce those connections you currently have.
Right. And just how critical that is. And to point out, not to bring it back to journalists, but there was a recent poll that shows that journalists are experiencing heightened levels of anxiety and depression related to this. And I guess I wonder, what do all of you do to deal with this anxiety or what the different mental health issues that come up during the coronavirus? I'll start. I was not a meditator. I didn't feel like that was something that fits my personality or that I could even really sit still for that long. But I've been trying to meditate a little bit every morning before I really start my day and start, as you said, Mike, doom scrolling. And it has helped. I definitely need an app to assist me to stay focused. And of course, yeah, calling loved ones and, potentially even going for some socially distant walks with friends when appropriate. Mike, do you have any thoughts or what have you been doing?
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, I take every opportunity I can to give myself a break. I've tried to, you know, it's really easy when you're working from home, which I've pretty much exclusively done since March. It's really easy for those lines to blur and for your work life and your home life to blend.
Right.
So especially when my kids go to bed, I like to draw a really hard line and transition myself to a spot of relaxation, whether it be listening to a podcast and, you know, coloring on my phone, which is a color by number app that I use to just kind of shut my brain off and in color, or right now, I mean, for as long as it lasts, I've got baseball to just give me something else angry or to make me angry about beyond coronavirus. So I think pretty much every expert out there suggests going outside and getting fresh air. I like to walk my dog for 3 or 4 miles at a time and just remove myself from that previously mentioned box that we're all kind of living in.
Yeah. And I know that your family got a dog during all of this. So congratulations. What's their name?
Her name's Luna, and she's just perfect. She's a husky. So she's pushing me to get outside a whole lot. And I have to do it. Otherwise my work / home will be destroyed. So it definitely forces my hand to go outside.
And Harrison, what have you been doing to take time for yourself?
Oh, you know, nothing. Actually, quite a bit now that I think about it. I've for about 10 years now, I've been a pretty avid road cyclist, and I've been doubling down on that. Mm. But I found that getting outside really, really helps. The experts are not wrong.
Yeah.
Unplugging in a lot of ways. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I also tend to take up a little bit of study. So in college, I was kind of a classics buff. And I've picked up a few of the old texts from back in the day, and really decided to kind of like focus on something that's really kind of there on the printed page in front of me. I found that nothing cures anxiety like finding something to focus on and just giving it an hour of your life.
Yeah. And Heath, any thoughts?
Well, I definitely try to get out on the trails as much as I can. I do a lot of mountain biking and hiking and fly fishing when I can. So that helps a ton, and I'm grateful that we live in a place where that is readily available. And then I've always liked cooking, but now I'm doing a lot more of it. Obviously. So that really helps. I've been really trying to challenge myself in the kitchen, and I brew beer at home too. And that's been a really good activity where, you know, I kind of have to unplug for that because I've got to pay attention to what I'm doing. Otherwise my beer won't taste good. So,
right.
So yeah, all of those things have really helped a lot.
Well, thanks everyone for sharing those. And we will be back after a quick break, back to the Friday Reporter Roundtable. I'm Frankie Barnhill. You're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters and the Friday Reporter Roundtable. I'm Frankie Barnhill, filling in for Gemma Gaudette. We have Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio News, Harrison Berry of the Boise Weekly, and Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on Your Side, sharing the headlines and going beyond what happened in the headlines this week. Mike, I want to start with you in this segment. The federal government put an eviction moratorium in place at the start of the pandemic to keep folks housed even during the most severe recession we've seen in decades. What's going on with that now? And what are you hearing from people, Idahoans, who are relying on that moratorium?
Yeah, so my colleague over here, Madeline White, has been digging into these issues since the beginning of quarantine and the effect on the economy. And what we found is obviously everything's super complicated. And a lot of times if you trust the kind of the bumper sticker explanations, you'll be led astray. And one of those is, you know, the moratorium on evictions. Well, that's not really the case unless you live in a place where that's specifically being supported by federal loans, loans held by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So that is expiring at the end of this month. So as of today, And what we're hearing is there's roughly about 24% of Idaho adults are missing last month's rent or mortgage payments. So there's this huge portion, I mean, nearly a quarter of our community that is not making ends meet in that way. So there are a lot of people who are going to be left out of that. I want to make sure it's clear that, you know, those people who are outside of this Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgages that are federally backed, they're kind of left out in the cold. There are programs that are available to them and they should be encouraged to. You can go to idahonews6.com and see our rebound page that has some links there for them. The at-risk renters, they are encouraged to go to Idaho Housing and Finance Association. They have a housing preservation program providing short-term rental assistance to people. I mean, when it boils down to it, sitting on this day, and anybody who's experienced this knows the stress. You know, we just talked about anxiety. But when you're talking about July 31st and you know your rent is due August 1st and you had these protections that seemed so far away, right? Like this 90-day protections 90 days ago, why even worry about it? This whole problem is going to go away. Well, it didn't. And now you have this stress that's sitting on you. And so CATCH, the organization in Boise, is encouraging people, if you have a pen and paper near you, write this number down. It's 208-246-8830. That's 208-246-8830. You could also just go to our website, or like I mentioned, Idaho Housing and Finance Association. There are tons of organizations that are out there trying to do the work, these nonprofits that are dedicating themselves to try to keep you off the street, because we know the situation just gets so much worse if you end up without housing that you can depend on. It's going to make the spread of this virus and the long-term health effects as well as mental health effects so much more worse.
Right. And at the same time, the $600 per week federal unemployment aid has expired, and Congress has been unable to negotiate a deal to reinstate it, either at that $600 a week level or lower. Of course, there's still state unemployment benefits available. But how does that play into the question of folks being able to make their rent in Idaho?
I mean, it all feeds into it, right? That $600, and it's so interesting to watch these issues play out at a national scale or a federal scale, and see the disconnect from a lot of the people making the decisions and the individuals who are actually suffering through this. And that $600 is perceived, because sometimes it exceeds the pay of individuals if they're making that $600 plus their state unemployment. But when it boils down to it, if you do not have a dependable income, that stress is going to repeat every single month, and not just once a month. You're talking about SNAP benefits that expire a lot of times 2 weeks into the month, or 2 weeks into your 30-day period where you're supposed to be using them. You have a greater stress that's being put on the nonprofit networks that's beyond the safety net programs that are federally funded, like the Idaho Food Bank, which is distributing more food than it ever has been, but can only reach so many people. All while a lot of these people, you know, if we pull ourselves out of the Boise perspective, you know, you're talking about a lot of these rural parts of the state that may have one brick and mortar pantry within 100 miles. And maybe their nearest grocery store doesn't sell fresh fruits and vegetables. It's actually a gas station or convenience store that they can access the food there. So there's this whole other effect on rural Idaho that has yet to totally be felt. What I would encourage people to do is, you know, call 211, reach out to the organizations that are there, but also the most important thing really is to recognize that you're in a position to ask for help,
right?
And ask for that help. A lot of times there's a perception or a stigma around requesting that assistance. I have been the person sitting in my car outside of a food pantry when I first got started in radio, sobbing because I didn't want to walk into that door because it was admitting defeat, when in reality, it was taking one thing off my shoulders so I could focus on all the other things that were going on in my life, pay all those other bills, catch up on these other things. Those assistance programs are there for a reason, and they're expanding. The Idaho Food Bank has mobile food distributions that are going out to rural communities. And it's not just them, right? There are nonprofits that are in your community that are doing good work. The other thing to think about is, even if you are in maybe a community that, or a neighborhood that feels like it's not being hit in this way, It is. There are community members, especially the elderly in our communities, that are being hit the hardest. Check in on those individuals. See, maybe you don't need to go to the food bank, but maybe your neighbor two blocks away does need to go to the food bank. It doesn't have a car or mode of transportation, or maybe is in a immunocompromised situation where they don't feel comfortable doing it. So taking that extra step and going and maybe picking up a box of food for an individual that's not going to cost you anything aside from gas and the risk of going out into the community. Looking out for each other in this time is really, really important.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing those resources. And my producer, Troy Oppy, just pointed out too that, yeah, the YMCA is still doing those pickups. So that's another resource out there. Harrison, I want to turn to you for another story that you've been following, which is around three Idaho high schools that have recently dropped their Indigenous-themed mascots, all within about the same this last year. What schools are we talking about, and what has the reaction been to removing them?
Well, to begin with, we're talking about Boise High School. We're talking about Nez Perce High School. And we're talking about Teton High School. Really, kind of, you know, if Idaho has three corners, you found schools to represent each of them. But the conversations surrounding the changes in those mascots have really been different everywhere you go. In Boise, I wouldn't say that there has been necessarily acrimony, but when we reached out to school officials, they said that they got quite a bit of pushback from some people in the community, who insisted that, you know, once a Boise Brave, always a Boise Brave, and that Indigenous themed mascot is part of who they are. Mm. In a lot of ways, that kind of stifled the move toward actually turning to that kind of concept of bravery itself. Boise Brave is the new mascot. I know that to some that might seem like a very flat-footed kind of a way to do that, but it did, at the end of the day, nix that Native American association. Now in Teton, it's been considerably more acrimonious. Our reporting shows that a lot of people there are very attached to that particular mascot, the Redskins. The school has since opted to change its mascot, and up in Nez Perce, the conversation has been comparatively tame. It really was a move that was designed to, that took place actually in part because that's one of the few schools around that mandates every student graduate having taken a North or a Pacific Northwest history class, which includes significant input from local tribes. So you really have kind of a spectrum going on here.
Yeah.
And that spectrum really changes the kind of conversation that surrounds that decision to walk away from these Native themed mascots.
Yeah, and Harrison, we need to take a break in a minute, but quickly, what has the reaction been from Idaho Indigenous peoples themselves? What do they think about these changes? Do they think it's enough?
Well, we spoke to members of quite a few tribes here in Idaho, and they reacted very positively to those decisions on the part of school districts. And they say that for a long time, they had felt shut out of the decisions on the part to keep mascots for a long time. Including them in those conversations, they say, went a long way toward helping get those mascots removed. So on the whole, they've been very laudatory about the new kinds of communications that they're getting from school districts and communities in regards to these mascots, which they say are extremely harmful to Native communities.
Yeah, and of course, you know, Indigenous folks don't speak as a monolithic group. There are varying views within that, but that's interesting to hear. We are going to continue our Friday Reporter Roundtable in just a moment. Stick with us. Listening to Idaho Matters, I'm Frankie Barnhill, filling in for Gemma Gaudette. We're wrapping up our Friday Reporter Roundtable with Heath Drusen of Boise State Public Radio News, Harrison Berry of the Boise Weekly, and Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side. Heath, you have been following rallies for racial justice and Black Lives Matter in Idaho and other states in the Mountain West. Specifically, you've been looking at the presence of firearms at these rallies. From folks there to protest Black Lives Matter, what are you finding?
Yeah, what I'm finding is actually that there has been an increasing number of violent incidents, and it seems that people on both sides, or really, I guess I should say all sides, since it's pretty murky here, are starting to arm themselves. So you already had so-called counter-protesters who have come out with a variety of different messages to sort of oppose Black Lives Matter protests. And a lot of them had come armed. That was a trend that we'd already been seeing. And now you're seeing some Black Lives Matter protesters and people calling for police reform arming themselves to defend themselves because they feel threatened by these guys. Well, as you can imagine, you've got emotional protests, you've got people arguing, and now you put firearms into the mix and it's boiled over and sometimes to deadly effects.
Wow. And I guess remind folks about what happened here in Boise in early June even.
That's right. So fortunately, nobody was hurt, but there was a young man who had a rifle, and he appeared to be with some counter protesters at a Black Lives Matter event, and he fired a round from his rifle into the ground. It's a little unclear whether it was on purpose or an accident. It was originally ruled an accident, and then police said it was not clear. And then we also had an incident not too long ago where a woman pointed a handgun at some protesters as well. No shots were fired. Again, nobody was injured. Fortunately, things have not gotten out of control in Boise, but it's been really close to things getting out of hand.
What do these folks say about why they carry weapons at these, already really emotional rallies?
So it's a mix. Some folks are carrying weapons as sort of, oddly enough, more of a speech issue, just to say, hey, I'm here for the Second Amendment. We're allowed to carry our weapons, so I'm carrying them because I can carry them. Other folks say that they are there to protect businesses. Certainly, we have seen some rioting around the country, although there hasn't been that in Idaho. And what we've had more of here are these sort of fake reports of Antifa coming to riot and busloads of people coming. They never appear. It's rumors. It's not true. But there are people who come out and say they're there to defend against this sort of phantom threat. And then you've also got protesters who say they feel threatened. These are, some Black Lives Matter protesters who feel that they need to defend themselves because you have hostile counter-protesters who are themselves armed.
Yeah, wow. Seems like definitely something you'll continue following clearly and obviously, hopefully. None of these incidents are violent in our region. And Mike, I want to turn to you about a topic that occurred on Twitter, which we know is quite the place these days. President Trump tweeted this week that he may want to delay the November election. What was the response of Idaho officials, the Secretary of State, Lawrence Denny, other local county elections officials? What have they said about this idea?
Yeah, so my first reaction was to move as quickly as possible and get a response from the members of our delegation, which, to their credit, they were very responsive. Their staffs got quotes back to me. And you can read each of those. I'm at Sharp208. You can also go to Idaho News 6 if you want to read the full statements. And I would encourage people to do that because it's interesting to see the different perspectives of the different members of our delegation. I think Mike Simpson probably had the strongest condemnation of it. Representative Russ Fulcher maintained that there is some risk that is elevated because of mail-in voting, something that Heath actually hopped up yesterday to make sure it was noted, the fact that's just not upheld in facts in the data, that mail-in voting, just like absentee voting, has measures in place to keep that safe. Now, one of the interesting things we did find, though, was different responses from the Secretary of State's office. We spoke with Chad Houck, who's his chief deputy, and Phil McGrain, the Ada County clerk. Very different perspectives on the safe nature of mail-in voting and the mail-in ballots and absentee voting. Phil McGrain is encouraging people to to vote through absentee ballots and trying to keep people safe without encouraging people to come into a closed room and stand around a bunch of other people, especially, you know, seniors who typically are the poll workers who run the elections in the first place. And a lot of times are the ones who are catching COVID and seeing the worst outcomes. So whereas Chad Houck in the Secretary of State's office maintains that there is a risk to mail-in voting, which I'm sure connects with Lawrence Denny, our Secretary of State, in his opinions. So we are digging deeper into that. You're going to see a follow-up report coming next week, where we're going to delve into their actual arguments and show the data. And really, at this point, you know, there is a lot of reporting. There are instances of fraud that are caught.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the safeguards that are in place, because, and frankly, Idaho deserves some credit in the safeguards that are there. Those safeguards help protect us with barcodes, with signatures, with double checking and signing affidavits, and these other programs that we have. It's the same as voting in person based on the data we're seeing, that just as somebody can show up with somebody else's identification and pretend to be them and vote in person if they wanted to, it can happen just as well with mail-in voting, but it's very difficult to pull off a massive voting fraud scheme, as opposed to what we saw in the 2016 election that's been verified by intelligence officials and our own government, that, you know, outside influences can sway an election through other means, social media and coordinated campaigns to try to sway people's opinions, which is a whole other thing.
Right, of course. And I should note, just to fact check, you know, Congress is the only entity that can actually change when the election can take place. So, all right. Well, I have one final question for all of you panelists. Are you ready? It's a tough one. What are you doing to escape the heat this weekend? Triple digit heat in the Treasure Valley. Let's see, Heath, what are you going to do?
Well, I'm not doing a very good job of it because I'm going to be working tomorrow in Twin Falls. But I am going to take a little inflatable kayak down the Boise River. So that might help.
I bet that will help. Harrison, what do you think?
Well, I might have to second that floating the Boise River bit. I did that yesterday, and it was just absolutely fantastic. But I think everything else I do is just going to have to be in the morning or the evening. I'm posting up someplace cool, preferably indoors.
Right. And Mike?
Yeah, I'm going to avoid the sun as much as possible. I'm pretty much a vampire. I do not like being out in these temperatures. I did get an inflatable pool that I put out in my backyard so that I can go out and cool down with my two young kids and in a safe way. Yeah, I think the safest bet is to just try to stay as close, at least for me, try to stay as close to the air conditioning as possible.
Oh, Mike, I'm jealous. I'm going to try and find a kiddie pool to set up or something. So, yeah.
I have a chair sitting in it. It's a delightful experience.
Oh, my gosh. That sounds great. Well, thank you so much to everybody. We've been speaking with reporter Heath Druzin, Boise State Public Radio News, Harrison Berry of the Boise Weekly, and Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side. Enjoy your weekend, guys. Going to be a hot one.
Thank you.
Talk to you later. I'm Frankie Barnhill. You're listening to Idaho Matters.